Attica Blues, Archie Shepp. No more fitting song to open up the show today. I'm Michael Slate. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I have to tell you, as I said many times before, we know that there's got to be a better way of living than under this system. And that song kind of lays it out. There's a lot of hopes and dreams attached to what people want to live like. And it's up to us to actually bring that into being. And that's sort of the theme of today's show. At the back end of the show today, we got a very special treat, something I really look forward to bringing to you. Every year I try to bring out to people around this time of the year, all these holidays, all these times when the whole society, and it does seem to come from every corner of the society, they tell us 24/7 that we should all be really thankful for what we got. And this time of year, so much of this involves talking about, oh, the bountiful harvest, the full tables, and especially overstuffed stomachs. Well, I was thinking about this, and I want to poke around on this a little bit. You know, for that reason, I'm bringing you, at the end of the show, I'm bringing you a piece from Bob Avakian called The Right to Eat. And this piece gets into, why can't this system just give us all the right to eat? Think about that. We're constantly told that this is the best of all possible worlds, and yet they can't guarantee a basic right to eat. Well, I guarantee you this. This is going to give you a whole different perspective on this question. Before that, we'll be talking with Clyde Young. Clyde Young is from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's someone who, in the early years of his childhood, was sent to prison and ended up doing a long stretch when he was, I think, a teenager and led a rebellion in a prison and became a revolutionary and a revolutionary communist. We're going to be talking to him about that. And in our first segment, we're going to spend some time talking with Sarah and Emily Kunstler about a film, a documentary they made about their father called William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. But before we get into the meat of today's show, I thought I'd offer something that you just don't expect from me. You know, I'm a committed atheist, and so I don't really do this very often. What I'm going to do is open up today's show with a prayer, a very special prayer, appropriate to the American holiday season. And this prayer is a Thanksgiving prayer from the late novelist William S. Burroughs.
For John Dillinger, and hope he is still alive. Thanksgiving Day, November 28th, 1986. Thanks for the wild turkey and the passenger pigeons, destined to be out through wholesome American guts. Thanks for a continent to despoil and poison. Thanks for Indians to provide a modicum of challenge and danger. Thanks for vast herds of bison to kill and skin, leaving the carcasses to rot. Thanks for bounties on wolves and coyotes. Thanks for the American dream to vulgarize and falsify until the bare lies shine through. Thanks for the KKK, for niggers killing lawmen, thieving their notches, for decent church-going women with their mean, pinched, bitter, evil faces. Thanks for Killer Queer for Christ stickers. Thanks for the Boratory AIDS. Thanks for Prohibition and the war against drugs. Thanks for a country where nobody's allowed to mind his own business. Thanks for a nation of finks. Yes. Thanks for all the memories. All right, let's see your arms. You always were a headache and you always were a bore. Thanks for the last and greatest betrayal of the last and greatest of human dreams.
That was William S. Burroughs with a Thanksgiving prayer, and I think that really sets the proper mood for the rest of the show today. During the week of November 16th, Attorney Lynn Stewart was ordered into jail by the government. This is something that should outrage every single listener to this show. You know, I don't insist that you agree with me up and down the line on everything we talk about each week, but this is something we should all be together on. On this one thing we should all be together, this is an outrageous assault on one of the most courageous and radical attorneys in the country today. And it's something we all need to speak out against. Lynn's an attorney who dedicated her life to standing with and defending the people, especially politically progressive and radical people. And she defends them against the machine. Lynn was railroaded on trumped up charges. And if you don't know about her case, you really should. So I'd urge you to Google her, Lynn Stewart, LynnStewart. Look her up and see what the case is all about. And I hope that, like me, you're going to be really angry about this. Look it up and then decide what you need to do. So this kind of sets the stage for our first conversation. This new film about William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, it's a story of one of the most important radical lawyers in U.S. history. You know, these are times when the idea of people acting based on their convictions seems to be very rare and strange. And instead, a whole lot of people are talking about real politic and operating within the confines that we've been handed by the powers that be. And in this context, many, many people need to see this important film. You'll not only learn about who Bill Kunstler was and about the times that changed him and in turn, the ways that he helped to change those times, but you're going to be inspired and challenged, I guarantee that, by what you see. We're joined in studio today by the filmmakers. We're joined in studio by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. Two people who I have been really, really anxious to speak with. They have produced, directed a tremendous film. I was telling them I sat and watched it twice last night, and I'm ready to go back tonight to watch it again. And Sarah, Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I guess actually what I'll do before we start talking, why don't we play the trailer just to give people a sense of what's going on with this film.
That's the terrible myth of organized society, that everything that's done through the established system is legal, and that word has a powerful psychological impact.
All I want to say is all power to the people, right on, do it.
Get them up, get them up.
Now, as a premier, we will have William M. Kunstler, yes, the real William M. Kunstler, appear and talk about his life.
Here you had this man who stood for radical politics, and now he was representing people whose values were anathema to most of us.
If you do not decide this case on the evidence, someday, somewhere, you will wake up screaming.
I said, let's not do this one. It puts you two in danger.
Kunstler is a traitor! Kunstler is a traitor!
Obviously, he didn't listen to me.
I was kind of wondering if ever you decided to take a case and then later, you know, did a double take and said, I shouldn't be doing this. This isn't something that in my heart I believe is right.
It's very, very hard to look Bill Kunstler's daughter in the eye and to say that I thought he was a hypocrite.
I suspect that better men
than the world has known. And more of them have gone to their death through a legal system than through all the illegalities in the history of man.
Wow. That last statement just kind of concentrates so much about your dad and about the film, but especially about your dad and the questions that were posed. I guess I'll start out with the question that probably everybody starts out with, and then I'll take it off in directions that you don't expect. But what made you make the film? Why'd you make it?
This is Emily speaking. Sarah and I, at the time we made this film, have been making films together for about 6 or 7 years, mostly small films, advocacy films for people in prison. And we were getting to our late 20s and starting to think about why we were doing the work we were doing, trying to draw strength from the work other people had done, and for the first time really thinking about our work in respect to our father's work. And we thought that there wasn't a better time to really start that investigation and share that story with other people.
Any film is both exhilarating and torturous to make, you know, in a certain sense. It's sort of, and especially with this film, where you're confronting something, where you have personal relationship that is going to be told through the story. And it's a very contradictory personal relationship that intersects in contradictory ways with the very public person that your dad was. And as I was telling you earlier, it's and you know, everybody has a William Kunstler story. There's a moment in their life that crisscrosses, especially people who have been around the movement or have generally been around anything fighting against oppression and against injustice. There's always that moment. But you guys have a whole lifetime of this. It must have been a very complex path to take and a journey to make.
Yeah, well, this is Sarah. Making this film, I think our biggest challenge was figuring out how to include ourselves in it, how much of the personal story to tell, whether we were just going to make a straight biopic about our father or whether we were going to allow our personal narrative and relationship with him to seep into the film. And it's when you have a father who's such a public person and takes up so much space, it can be hard to feel like you fit in the room at all. So telling the personal story was definitely a challenge.
Have you been talking to my son? It's interesting when you say trying to work yourself into it, into the film, because one of the things that happens very, and I think with you guys doing this, with you folks working yourself into the film, the way you did it really brought out the complexity of the situation. It's not just sort of, it's not a woke up one day, said, whoa, everything I've been doing is wrong. Now I'm going to do what's right. And then everybody loves me, because there's a whole thing, even in terms of the contradictions you had in your relationship with your dad in relation to what he was doing. I thought it was really interesting. It seems like what he was doing actually really put you guys into a jam where it was sort of like, wait a minute, what are you doing? We don't agree with this stuff. And you had to go into that. You had to tell that story in the film. You didn't make an easy film. You didn't leave questions that were, you didn't just answer the easy questions. You actually took on some very tough ones. How was it doing that?
This is Emily speaking. Even in his lifetime, he encouraged us to ask questions. So this wasn't something we only started doing after he passed away. And I think that Sarah and I hoped that through our telling of this story, we would invite, you know, a younger audience to be interested in that time period. We don't meet many people from our generation who have heard of our father. So we thought that this might be a great window in for a lot of people.
And actually, this is Sarah. I'd like to frame the story a little bit for your audience who might not know who he is. Before we were born, he had these glory days that he used to tell us about, where he worked with Martin Luther King, where he represented the Freedom Riders in the South during the Civil Rights Movement, where he represented the Chicago Eight, the anti-war activists protesting the Vietnam War, represented inmates in Attica when they rose up against the prison conditions, the American Indian Movement at Wounded Knee, when they stood up for Native rights. And when we were growing up, he was pretty much staying in New York for the most part, representing criminal defendants, representing people accused of rape, terrorism, murder. For us as children, there was a stark contrast between one life that he had led and the life that we saw. And part of making this film was kind of getting at the heart of that, to try to, you know, to find out if he'd changed and how he changed and what it meant for us.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Sarah and Emily Kunstler, and we're talking about their latest film, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe, a really powerful and beautiful documentary about their father, William Kunstler. When you're talking about what William Kunstler was to people, and people from my generation, that was a name that just concentrated so much about the movement and the more revolutionary edge of the movement. And I think this is what you capture in the film a lot. There's a transformation that goes on through the entire film, both with him, which you watch a number of different transformations, and then there's a very gripping transformation for both of you, too. It's interesting because I was looking at that one moment where you said the proudest moment you had of your father was the day that he actually became radicalized. Mm-hmm. So you had this sort of transformation. It sort of seemed to go from what you were talking about when you knew him, his glory days were behind him in a certain sense. But then there's a whole there's a whole process where you go from that and then you recognize his radicalization, get to that proudest moment through learning about it from other people, basically. And then you have to deal with all the other stuff. That was part of the power of the film, the story of transformation that runs throughout the film on many different levels.
Yeah, I mean, this is Emily. It's very much a story about transformation, his transformation, our transformation, the transformation of people who were affected by movements that he was a part of throughout the film. One of the things that we really take strength from our father's story is that it was his ability to transform himself, was how he traveled south when he was approaching 50 and was exposed to southern racism, and it changed the course of his life and the direction of his life from that point forward. So we take great strength from that, and it's really exciting to think that people can make those kinds of change at any point in their life.
This is Sarah. I just wanted, last night we showed the film at UC Santa Barbara to some of the students there, and in the audience was a man who described himself as a
reformed FBI agent.
Ooh.
And he came to the film to tell us that he had known our father, that he had been at Wounded Knee during the 71-day standoff between the American Indians and the federal government, that he had testified at the resulting trial that came after that. And he shared two things with us. He said, one, that you haven't lived until you've been cross-examined by William Kunstler. And the second piece he shared with us was that he was the FBI agent who, during the course of that trial, came clean about the illegal government wiretaps, part of the reason why the judge ultimately dismissed the case against the defendants that were charged. We wish we met him while we were making the film.
Right, yeah. It's interesting because, as I was saying again, I'll raise that thing about the everybody has their consular moment. And for me, there were actually two that were very close together. I was like 25, something like that. And I was going to interview your dad, and I was just starting out in writing for as a journalist and interviewing people. And I went down to the courtroom in Manhattan and caught up with him, and he was like very friendly and open. And we had some mutual friends, so it sort of opened a few doors. And I was talking to him about different political cases, just sort of as gabbing in the beginning. And he was very interested in following things and wanted to know what was going on. And then he says, but right now what I'm doing is I'm mainly defending people like today, this guy who's been busted on a massive drug dealing charge. And he said, so what do you think of that? I said, I had a kind of reaction, not like you guys have, but sort of a reaction of like, wow, what's up with this? And he invited me to come into the courtroom. And it was one of these astounding cases where the DA had a piece of cardboard, like with a tinfoil and then saran wrap over a mountain of white powder. And he kept walking around with it. And that was his evidence. And I'm looking at your dad and I'm thinking, there's nothing you can do about it. And he got up at a moment. He just said, watch this. And he took that and he demolished the case by just cracking open a little shadow of doubt, a little shade of doubt, you know. And he won. When he got out, I was sort of standing there. We went to lunch and he says, you know, the reason I do this is because I see. And I think this is something that both of you discovered in making the film, where the point about he never asked or was never concerned about the innocence of one of the people that he was representing. He says, look, I watched that day after day for a century or more, the poorest of the poor, the most oppressed in the country have been ground up by this machine. And I'm putting myself in front of that machine, and I'm fighting to pull whoever I can out of that machine. And there was a certain largeness of mind and a bigness of understanding that really struck me. And then literally 3 days later, I saw something else. I was in Bed-Stuy. The New York police had killed a mentally disabled Puerto Rican guy. And it was a huge rebellion developing. And it was lots of discussion in the park about whether people were going to throw down with the police or march off and try to demand some kind of reform. And I was standing on a hill with your dad. And he looks and I'm saying, what are you going to do? And he says, I don't know what I'm going to do. And then in the side of the park, a group of black youth, maybe 100, 200 black youth came in. They had marched all the way down Flatbush. And they had, you know, from the Manhattan Bridge, and they came down and they're beating trash can lids with sticks and they're chanting, no more rapping, let's get scrapping. And I turned around and your dad had a smile a mile wide and he said, you couldn't ask for a better day. And it really captured something for me because everything he did, it seemed that that was actually what motivated him. I mean, all the courtroom theatrics, everything else, it was motivated on, I'm not going to stand by and let all this injustice happen without throwing myself in front of it. And you bring that out very well in the film.
Well, he really drew strength from people willing to take risks for what they believed in. You know, one of the stories that we tell in our film that Bill told us was the story of Michelangelo's Statue of David. And for him, that, you know, that statue was sculpted before David threw the rock. So it, for him, it was about this moment of choice, decision making. And he really fixated on that moment, saying that everybody really has this option in their lives to take a stand for what they believe in. And we're all faced with these moments, these David moments.
And I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and it's the Michael Slate Show. And we're talking with Emily and Sarah Kunstler, the filmmakers of William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. One of the things I thought that was really interesting when you tell that David story, because there's a whole point that he makes about, in a way, he was saying it to people around this one particular decision they had, the jury in a case. But there's a lot of ways he was actually posing that question to people, and especially to young people, but to all people, that if you don't make a decision based on principle and on what's right, that you are somewhere someday going to wake up screaming. And to me, that was something that was really marked his life. And I thought you brought that out really well. He puts himself in a position where he's standing there and he knows if he did something, it might have tremendous repercussions. But if he doesn't, he could also walk away quietly and not do it.
Mm-hmm.
You're left wondering, well, what is the strength? Where did he draw his strength to do what was right? There aren't many people who are as principled and consistently principled in their life as your dad was. It was really a remarkable thing.
And that energetic.
Yeah, yeah. And it meant something to people. You know, it really meant. I mean, it was very moving to see that people at his memorial, the people who came and testified to this and the difference that it made in people's lives. One thing I wanted to ask you about was Attica. One of the reasons I want to ask you about it, because I know the take, you can explain to people what your take on Attica was in the film, and then I wanted to ask you a couple questions about that.
Well, in the film, we tell the story of the inmate takeover of Attica and the 3 days where the prisoners tried to negotiate better living conditions and with the state of New York, and ultimately the tragic end to that uprising, which was the state taking the prison back by force. And it was a real personal moment for our father, because he went there and he was an observer and ended up being the lawyer for the inmates in their negotiations with the state. And we came to the conclusion, speaking to people, that he was too idealistic about what was going to happen, that he let his idealism and his joy in the struggle and revolution and rebellion of that moment cloud his thinking a little bit, and he wasn't able to really warn the inmates about what the stakes really were before the government came in killing people.
You know, and that's what I want to talk about a little bit, because, you know, I had a little bit of a different take on it, including, I mean, one of the things I think that your dad grasped to a certain extent, I think the prisoners did too, is that they were living day after day under a very brutal regime who was killing them just on GPs, you know, that's routine practice. And I think I always thought about this thing of, what do you do if you're on a slave ship and you have a chance to rebel? You're in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. You have a chance to rebel. You don't know anything about a ship, but do you rebel? You know, Attica was a tragedy. It was a crime against humanity. It was a symptom of the sickness of this whole system. But it was also, that's in terms of what they did, but it was also, Attica became something that really galvanized a lot of people. And your dad, that's one of the things I thought your dad really did, is it wasn't an empty defiance, but it was a defiance in that he called on people to actually live beyond themselves, to live for something more beyond themselves, and the meaningful existence that he was arguing for everyone to take up. And he was actually serving as a model to take up. And a lot of that was rooted in, as he said, you know, he became very revolutionary in his thinking, and he hated this system, you know, and he inspired a lot of people to do that. So I just wanted to put that out as
Well, you know, I think that over the years, our father saw a lot of his friends and people that he worked with killed, starting, you know, from his work early in the civil rights movement. And I think, you know, he carried a great deal of responsibility and even guilt for knowing that ultimately, as a lawyer, he would be protected. So after Attica, to advise people to take this risk, you know, it was very heavy for him. Because ultimately, it wasn't his risk to take. But, you know, it wasn't all bad. I mean, there was a response to Attica. It did get educational programs into prison, at least for a period of time. So that it definitely brought about some awareness in terms of the bad prison conditions in New York and beyond.
And I think even if you look at most of the Attica brothers, at least the ones that I knew over the period of time, nobody looked at your dad's advice as being responsible for what happened there. It was Rockefeller, the system, the state, the rest of this stuff. That's actually what brought this down. And I think it's really important. People, and I understand that. I think that's part of the beauty of your film, is you bring the complexity of all the human relationships in that, you know, including your own very personal relationship with your dad and trying to assess what's going on. And also, you do a remarkable job of bringing out the social conditions and this is, you know, what's going on in the society in terms of conditioning all of that. So I want to thank you very much for a really, really wonderful film. Emily, Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. And let me remind people again, the film is William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. Spread the word. And one thing for people who are listening, how can they actually arrange to have a showing in their city?
Well, we're actually opening in 16 cities to start, and a list of those is on our website at disturbingtheuniverse.com. And if you don't see your city there, you can call your local art house theater and talk to the manager and request it, and that actually has an impact.
Okay.
And then the film will also be on PBS on the series POV in this upcoming season, in the spring-summer 2010 season as well.
I'm so happy about that. That's great. Millions and millions of people will see it on that. That's really tremendous. Emily, Sarah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Emily and Sarah Kunstler about their new film, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Clyde Young. Once again, from Attica Blues, Blues for Brother George Jackson, Archie Shepp. Attica Blues is just an album I'll continue to mine because it's so powerful and so meaningful, and it's becoming even more so as time goes on. I want to welcome to the show now Clyde Young. He's a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and he's someone who he's been out speaking on a special issue of the Revolution newspaper, a special issue around prisons and prisoners. And I asked Clyde to join us today. I thought in particular, this is sort of a theme running through the show. And Clyde was a young guy who went to prison at an early age. He was a youth from the inner city. And like many in this society, ended up, that was the choice that was given them, was prison or death. He ended up in prison. And in prison, he became a revolutionary and a revolutionary communist. And he's continued to this day to fight for a whole better future for humanity. Clyde, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Well, why don't we talk about, you know, Bob Avakian posed the question, what kind of system is it that the only future that it offers for youth in the inner cities is prison or death?
Mm-hmm.
What does that have to do with what we're talking about today?
Well, you know, I think if you look at what's going on in the prisons now, it was bad enough when I was in there, but it's worse now when you have 2.3 million people incarcerated in prisons for men, and then you have over 200,000 women incarcerated there. And then if you look at the conditions that people are living under, particularly the torture that's going on, the mental torture in the form of supermax isolation that people are confined to, and the brutality, beatings and other things that go on in the prison, it's really a form of trying to break people's spirit and to break them down. This is something I'm very familiar with, and, you know, it is something that I experienced myself when I was in prison.
Tell us about that. What do you mean you're very familiar?
Well, you know, for example, if you take just the mental torture of isolation, I was in solitary and in the hole many times. The difference between the two is that when you're in solitary, you're often locked in a cell where you do have access to hollering down the range to other people who are also similarly locked up. But when you're in the hole, it's, you're there by yourself, and all you have is your thoughts and whatever songs you can remember, and well, that's what gets you by. But these supermax prisons that they have, in fact, I had a friend, maybe this is a way I can kind of concentrate the story. I had a friend in prison who basically was a guy similar to myself who came up in the rough areas of the city that I lived in. He went to prison, and he beat up a guard. So they locked him up, and they kept him in solitary, in segregation, I should say, for 2 years, and he eventually killed himself. I mean, this gives you an idea of the kind of mental torture that goes on under those circumstances when you're just in segregation. These days, you're locked up where you have no human contact whatsoever, and people are locked in those conditions for years and years.
Well, you went into prison, what, the early 70s?
Yeah, I went in the late 60s.
And I mean, your story is actually very, very compelling in the sense of which people, by the way, people can read an interview with Clyde in a book called The Bandana Republic. It's a literary anthology by gang members and their affiliates. It's edited by Luis Reyes Rivera and Bruce George. And it's a really compelling book. And Clyde, and your interviewing this is really, it actually sets a, really puts things out in a very sharp and very, very revolutionary perspective.
Yeah,
on this,
thanks, Mike. Yeah. Thanks.
One of the things that you mentioned in there that from an early age, like you're saying, 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
and the things that you went through there, and this thing about breaking down the spirit.
Right.
And I think about that in the sense of, you know, okay, that's the early 60s that you were 12 years old.
Right, right.
And then in the 70s, the prison population starts to just mushroom to the point where you're talking about today.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what happened there. People want to understand what happened from a time when you had prison and it was a rite of passage almost, to, or it was actually very common, especially in the neighborhoods of the oppressed nationalities and especially in black neighborhoods among black people.
Right.
Prison was something everybody knew somebody or had been to prison.
Right.
Today, it's even more so. This is something that people actually just sort of factor into their growing up, coming of
exactly.
age. When you look at, what is it, 1 in 8 young black men are in, are in jail?
Exactly.
You know, this is just outrageous.
Yes.
So what is it that led to that kind of situation?
Well, you know, I think, you know, in the 1960s, it was a period of much revolutionary upheaval. You had groups like the Black Panther Party, and then you also had struggles among women. You had struggles against the war and all those kinds of things that were going on at that time. And many people in prison, not just myself, but many, many people became revolutionaries when they were behind the walls. And in fact, there was an interaction between the movement that was going on in society as a whole and what was going on in the prison. People influenced people like George Jackson, who was behind the prison walls, and in turn, his writings and the things that he did and others, like, for instance, in Attica, what they did influenced the struggle that was going on outside the walls. So this was a serious challenge that was being, at the same time, you also had urban rebellions throughout country, and all of this was intersecting with what was going on in the world in terms of a revolutionary struggle on a world scale, and revolutionary China, which existed at that time. So you had this type of situation going on, which really rocked the system. Those struggles at that time really rocked the system and challenged its legitimacy for millions and millions of people. In that context, the rulers actually struck back with two things, a carrot and a stick, if you will. On the one hand, they basically launched a war against drugs. This is something that came from the Nixon administration all the way from the top. He, recognizing that black people were a problem, felt that this had to be dealt with, but had to be dealt with in a way that wasn't really visible to people, that they were actually consciously dealing with that. And I think this led to a skyrocketing of people being incarcerated behind prison walls.
When you look at actually the statistics where you have, you know, the vast majority of people who are in prison for on drug offenses are not the big kingpins.
Exactly.
They're people who are in for possession.
Exactly.
For using.
Exactly.
The down and out junkie on the corner that's actually, or somebody who's just been, you know, chipping a little bit here and there.
Exactly.
You know, sort of this is, and those are the people that end up in jail. You
exactly.
know, meanwhile, the people like Oliver North who are actually involved in all kinds of international trafficking are resting somewhere.
Exactly.
Or, you know,
exactly.
It was also very interesting that to see that the so many of the drug busts were actually for marijuana.
Yeah, and look at the New York prisons where they have the Rockefeller Law. I mean, you're arrested one time and you're sent to prison for a long prison stretch. You're arrested a second time. And this is for possession. Even someone like Gil Scott-Heron was actually arrested for possession and was sent to prison. And people are sent to prison for long periods of time. In Detroit, they also had a law, if you had a very small portion of, I think it was heroin, that you could be sent to prison for life. So these are the kinds of laws that they imposed, and all of it was in the context of bringing down the hammer on the struggle that existed at that time. You know, hundreds, if not thousands, of people were killed in the streets by the National Guard and the police. And also Panthers were not only arrested, but some of them were killed, notable figures being Bunchy Carter, who was killed at UCLA, and, you know, also George Jackson himself, who was assassinated in prison. These are the kinds of things that they were doing, even while, on the other hand, they were actually building up a buffer strata or a middle strata among black people as a way of containing what was going on at that time. So all of these policies, if you will, combined with the globalization that was going on at that time, where jobs were moving from the inner cities to the suburbs and ultimately to other parts of the world, this led to a situation where these inner cities were really devastated. And at the same time, they were carrying out this war on drugs and war on crime. And this led to a skyrocketing prison population that we see today.
I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today with Clyde Young, a man who became a revolutionary in prison and remains one today. We're talking about the horror of prisons in America and a special issue of Revolution newspaper on prisons and prisoners. If you want to check this issue out, you can access it online at www.revcom.us. That's www.revcom.us. Now, one of the things that you talked, and you alluded to this earlier, and I think it has to do a little bit, too, with we're going to move into talking about this special issue of Revolution Newspaper, right. But you became a revolutionary in prison.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, you can say, oh, well, that was easy because there was all this upsurge out, and there was people coming in and all this other stuff. On the other hand, actually digging into the kind of revolutionary theory and moving through a lot of different perspectives and coming to revolutionary communism. You make a point in your interview that's in the Bandana Republic. You make a point, which was originally done in the Revolutionary Worker. But you make a point there where you say that this was considered very, very dangerous by the authorities. To be sitting in the yard studying theory was considered very dangerous. And I keep thinking about all these prisoners that are in there today and the fact that all these people that came into jail in the context of not the urban rebellions, but in the context of this massive assault on black people and where there was, where the movement has effectively disappeared to a certain extent.
Right.
And so people are coming and there's still some people who are searching for this theory. And can you talk a little bit about why it was considered so dangerous? And then what role does things like Revolution Newspaper and this issue in particular, what does it bring out and what's the importance of this issue in relation to that?
Yeah. Well, to start here first, I think it's really amazing to me that under the conditions that people are living in these prisons now, which are much worse than they were when I was in there, in terms of the supermax prisons that they have and the conditions that people are living under, it's really amazing that people actually in those conditions where it's not only a form of torture, but some people even lose their minds or commit suicide under those circumstances. It's really amazing that people actually begin to take up and turn to revolutionary theory. And we get lots of letters from prisoners, and they're really lofty letters. One of them I remember that I talked about when I was on the panel in New York speaking for the Prisoners Revolutionary Literature Fund with Carl Dixon and Cornel West was this prisoner who wrote about being fascinated with science. And at the same time, he pointed out that basically it's not just important to really explore theory, but you have to actually change the world, too. So that's one of the stories that actually sticks with me that's really fascinating that prisoners go through that kind of thing. When I was in, basically, they did a lot to censor the literature that came in, and they were really concerned about the developing of a revolutionary movement inside the prison. They were very concerned about that. This was happening in places like Attica. This was happening in places like San Quentin, and they were very concerned about stopping that kind of thing from happening in the prison that I was in. And I can tell you a funny story, because they also censored the literature that came into the prisons. And so once I ordered two books, one of them I really wanted to have and the other one I didn't want to have. One of them was called Look Out, Whitey, Black Power is Going to Get Your Mama. You know, that was by, I think it was, I can't even remember his name right now. But I ordered that book along with Auntie Doreen by Ingalls. And guess which one I got? You know, I got the Auntie Doreen because they didn't know how powerful that book was. And they kept the one about Look Out, Whitey, Black Power is Going to Get Your Mama. So that's just a funny story to tell you about the censorship that went on in prison at that time. I think this issue is extremely important, both in terms of pointing to the, you know, it's a truly outrageous situation that's going on today, as I've indicated.
Can you explain what this issue of the paper is, actually?
The issue of the paper is entitled, if I can recall the title, From the Hell Holes of Incarceration to a Future of Emancipation. And these places really are hell holes. And I haven't spoken about the situation with women, which in many ways stands out pretty starkly. I mean, women face this oppression in society as a whole, and then they go into prison, and that becomes magnified. And you have everything from the kind of brutality that they face, but also just outright rape that goes on in prison and women's prisons. And they have no recourse for really following up on that. And I would encourage people to look at the article because it would take me a bit of time to explain, you know, some of the circumstances. But the point is that rape in prisons where women are raped by the guards, this is just an outrageous thing. It happens in society. You know, I think something like 37% of the women who go to prison have already been raped, and then they get in prison and they're raped by guards and have no recourse for really doing anything about that because of the way this prison system is actually the bureaucracy is set up. They have no way of actually having recourse for that. So all of what this issue is pointing to is that it's doing two things. One, it's pointing to the conditions that exist in the prison, and they're really horrendous. But at the same time, it's pointing to the fact that it's not necessary or the point, it's not important to just reform the prisons, but really we have to do away with this whole society, which actually produces these kinds of prisons and produces the kind of oppression that faces black people, Latinos, and other people in the society. We have to actually bring into being a whole new world. And if this is the best that these people can do, what they're doing with prisons. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to make revolution, but what's going on in these prisons today in terms of the kind of brutality that I've been speaking to and the kind of mental torture that goes on, the rape that goes on, that's reason enough to get rid of this system, to overthrow the system, and that's precisely one of the themes that comes out in this particular issue. And to do that, you need leadership, and we do have that leadership in Bob Avakian.
You know, that is one of the things that comes out very strongly. I mean, this whole point of there needs to be a whole new world.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And that's the point that comes out. And I keep thinking about this is not just something that revolutionaries or communists see and even people associated with the paper. It's also something that even the other side sees, because when you look at the alternative that's put out there, mm-hmm. they constantly are pushing this Christian fundamentalism
yes.
in prisoners.
Yes.
That's the alternative
yes.
you have to, yes. to the life in hell that you're yes. living in yes. the prisons. And this offers a whole different alternative.
Yes.
And I think people should check this issue of the paper out. They should check out the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund. I think the idea, you know, there's something I was telling you earlier, Clyde, about Gil Scott had a song called The Prisoner. And
yeah.
it's a very moving song. And in it, he makes a point towards the beginning of the song where he mm-hmm. says, he has the prisoner issuing a plea. Mm. And he says, brother and sister, we depend on you. We're
yeah.
counting on you.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
and that this relationship between the outside and the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dialectical relationship and very important that, mm-hmm. that people don't turn their backs on prisoners. And this kind of thinking, like this issue of the paper, gets spread out broadly in society as well as in the prisons,
right.
but broadly in society too.
Right.
Clyde, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank
today.
You for having me,
okay.
Michael.
I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Clyde Young about prisons and prisoners in this, the so-called freest country in history, and a special issue of Revolution Newspaper on prisons and prisoners. You can check this issue out at www.revcom.us. That's revcom.us. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
I dreamed I walked in heaven just the other night. There was so much beauty, so much light. Don't you wish it was true? Don't you wish it was true? An angel took my hand, said you don't have to hurry.
Welcome back. That was John Fogerty with Don't You Wish It Was True from his CD Revival. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. Each year around this time, I get to thinking about the world we're living in. And if you're at all concerned about the world today, you can't help but wonder why the hell all this stuff is going on. How many untold thousands of people have lost their homes and everything they ever had, including their dreams? How many people will ride out this holiday season barely able to eat enough to stay alive? If that. And yet, when the holidays come around, we're supposed to forget all this and be thankful for the supposedly wonderful life we got here. Well, I think it's time we started asking some fairly critical questions about all this. And let's start with asking the question, what kind of system is this that it cannot guarantee what should be a fundamental human right? The right for all of us. The right for all of us to eat. Well, let's listen to Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on this.
Let's come at the nature of the capitalist system from another angle, one which I've spoken to previously. The right to eat. Here there's mass starvation and mass malnutrition among billions of people, a very large section of the population of human beings on the earth today, who are not getting enough to eat. Just to take something very basic. Now, if you step back from the particulars of the way the world is, you hear people say, well, that's the way the world is. That's just the way life is. Life is not fair. Life ain't shit by itself. Life does not exist in a vacuum or an abstract. Life exists through the working out of contradictions rooted in the basic contradictions of a system that prevails at a given time. That's what goes on, not life in some abstract sense that somehow exists up in the sky unrelated to what's going on, or, you know, some force that works its way through human beings in some mystical sense. The reason, quote-unquote, life is not fair is because the capitalist system operates according to certain dynamics. And one of them is that most of the people in the world scramble to have barely enough to eat or don't succeed in having enough to eat. That is a daily existence for the majority of humanity. Now, if you step back from it, you would say to yourself, well, what could be more basic than the right to eat? What is more essential to life than the basic right to eat and to have some shelter and to have clothes? But in a concentrated sense, the right to eat, what could be more basic? How can it be that you have a world in which there is no right to eat, in which the great majority of humanity either does not have enough to eat or has to scuffle every day to try to get enough to eat? How can that be, especially amidst all the wealth there is in the world that surrounds and mocks people at every turn? Once again, materialism, dialectical materialism, teaches us that this is because of the fundamental production relations of capitalism. The fundamental contradiction of capitalism between the socially produced wealth and the private capitalist accumulation of that wealth by aggregations of competing capitalists. By the very phenomenon that's described by the preliminary transformation into capital, by the phenomenon of the need for capital to reproduce itself, not to reproduce social wealth to be distributed according to the needs of the people, but to reproduce itself as capital on an expanded scale. There's a vast difference between reproducing wealth on an expanded scale, which can be and is applied to meet social needs, and reproducing wealth on an expanded basis as capital. And in understanding that difference, you understand fundamental things about why the world is the way it is and how it could be radically different. The fact that there is no right to eat, something which was pointed out in the book Democracy, Can't We Do Better Than That, in other places, has to do, once again, with Marx's statement that right can never be higher than the economic structure of society and the culture conditioned thereby. In other words, because of the basic character of capitalist production relations and the fundamental contradiction of capitalism to which I've just spoken, there can be and there is no right to eat. You eat or don't eat according to the dictates of the dynamics of capitalist accumulation. If you can contribute to the reproduction of capital on an expanded scale, in profitable enough terms for this or that capitalist or aggregation of capital, you can eat to one degree or another. If you do not or cannot in a given time or circumstances, you cannot eat unless you go find some other way to get something to eat, which is what some people, for example, who've been basically locked out of the economic system, repeatedly strive to do. But they have no right to eat. If you step back and you say, what could be more basic to human association than the right of its the members who make up that association, or the people, the human beings who make up that human association, to eat? But it doesn't matter that that's a fundamental human need. It doesn't translate, that fundamental human need does not translate into a fundamental human right within the confines of the fundamental contradiction and the production relations and corresponding social relations and superstructure, including the laws of capitalist society. There's a fundamental need, there's no fundamental right. Why? Once again, because of the production relations, the social relations, and the corresponding superstructure, including politics and law, and the enforcement of law within the confines of a capitalist system. Or let's look at the parasitism of imperialism, which I've spoken to several points in the course of this talk. I referred to Marx's statement about the rosy dawn of capitalism, the entombment in the minds of millions of native peoples in Bolivia and other parts of Latin, what we call Latin America today, slavery, exploitation of child labor. This was the rosy dawn of the initial capitalist accumulation, sometimes called primitive accumulation of the capitalist system as a whole. But what is it today? What is the character and driving force of capitalist accumulation today in capitalism's stage of imperialism, its worldwide system of exploitation? It is exactly the reproduction on an even broader and more intense level in many ways of what Marx was describing sardonically and ironically in talking about the rosy dawn of capitalism. It is child labor, not just in one or a few countries in Europe, but on a massive scale, in the hundreds of millions. It is conditions of labor for masses of people, hundreds of millions, which are barely better than conditions of slavery. And not only conditions of labor, but conditions of life more broadly. It is the turning of human beings on a massive scale into the means to make wealth for others, even in the most degrading terms, such as the large-scale sex trade that goes on internationally today under imperialism. Throughout the world, this rosy dawn is being repeated in the twilight years of capitalism and what we must make the twilight and final years of capitalism in a broad historical sense. This is still the foundation of capitalism and imperialism. We must never allow people to be fooled by the fact that people go to business school, wear suits that cost in the thousands of dollars, and can speak an articulate language. They are still, not everyone who does that, but those who are representatives of this system are still standing on that pulpit of bones. They are still standing on the children who labor in horrific conditions every day of the week, 12 hours a day. They are still standing on the bodies of people torn to shred in the wars to enforce this exploitation. They are still standing on the bodies, broken and degraded, of the women who were traded like commodities and even worse in this system. They are still standing on the bodies of people all over the world who were driven from one set of horrendous conditions to even worse ones, uprooted and flung across the globe in the desperate search for some kind of life. They are still standing on that foundation. That is still the rosy nature of their system, no matter how they dress it up and no matter what intellectual accoutrements it may take on, what intellectual dress it may take on. And please understand, this is not an attack on intellectuals. I'm talking about the intellectual rationalizations and the people who speak as representatives and apologists and defenders of the capitalist system, whom you see go out and speak in refined terms. But that is refinement dripping with blood. It is what Malcolm X said, a bloody-jawed wolf with blood running down its jaw. It's like the movie Them or whatever it was, where you had to have special glasses to see the hyena-like nature of the people who were among us. This is the nature of this ruling class. This is not exaggeration or communist rhetoric and hyperbole. This is a reality which I am struggling to describe, to find the terms to describe in its full horrific dimensions. And we should understand this fully.
That was Bob Avakian on The Right to Eat. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of the show.
And I'd like to thank all of my guests today. And I'd also like to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa, Age for production assistance. And I especially want to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And until next week, remember, there is a whole other way we could be and should be living. A better way than under this system. But getting there depends on you and what you do. We're going to go out now with another piece from John Fogerty's Revival CD. This piece is called The River is Waiting.
Set our course for the crossing together.